What I'm searching for here for a few minutes is what constitutes spirituality in American culture. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is, and there are various ways of talking about this, and each has a somewhat different nuance, but what counts as God? I mean, spirituality has to do with God or the spirit or something like that. What counts as God for us as individuals? What counts as God for us as a nation? Not what in theory counts, not what are you told in sermons counts, but what actually, in the way in which we organize our daily lives and our national routines, functions as God? Or another way of saying it is, what actually functions as ultimate meaning in our lives? Let me try to give an example of what I mean by functioning. I had an acquaintance who was a therapist, and he told me once that he had a client who said that he thought that maybe he was a dog. And the therapist looked at him and said, "If you're a dog, don't sit there and talk to me. Get in the corner, get on the floor, and bark." That is to say, don't tell me what you think you are. If you think you're a dog, then be a dog, okay? But don't give me this other story, "I think maybe I'm a dog." What in the way in which we actually... So something about the way in which that person actually organized his life was different than the images he had in his head about who he was, okay? So I want to know, what about in the way in which we organize our lives, individually and nationally, functions as God, ultimate meaning, spirit, value? What are the central values? Another way of saying it is, if God is somehow associated with the good, I mean, if we can put those two words together, not all religions will do that, of course, but at least in our tradition, God normally has something to do with good, supreme good or something like that. What is it that we value individually and nationally at a practical level? Again, not in theory, not all those words you hear, but what do we actually value as good? Another way of thinking about it, and I don't know if this is going to wash over the long haul or not, I really don't know. What I think God is, at a functional level, is whatever we want more of.
Like money.
Like money.
More personal freedom.
More personal freedom. It can be good, it can be bad. At this point, I'm not making a value judgment about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's whatever we want. Now, not every moment to moment. I mean, at this, you know, a few minutes ago, I wanted a little more coffee. That doesn't quite mean that coffee's God. So you have to say, what is it you want more of such that you're willing to make a number of sacrifices to get it? Or that you automatically go for more and more of it? What is it that functions as the more? I think this is not entirely unreasonable, though I said this may not wash in the long haul. Because, you know, in kind of native religion, God is the more. That's what God is. You see a rock, and you say there's something more behind the rock. You see a tree, you say there's something more behind the tree. You see the clouds and nature around you, and you say, this is not enough. This is not all there is. There is something more. So God becomes the more. And you hear thunder, and you say, in some religions, you say, well, you know, those are the gods fighting or drumming or whatever it may be. It's the thunder at a kind of phenomenal level, at a lived, everyday level, but we want to say God is the more behind the whatever it is. So I think it's not entirely unreasonable to say that whatever functions as more is God to us. It's a kind of criterion. See, I say, what if God is ultimate reality? But ultimate reality is so spacey that, you know, it's kind of hard to talk about, you know? I mean, I think it's a nice description. Tillich, ultimate meaning, you know, whatever is ultimately meaningful to you is God. Whatever is ultimately meaningful is God. So what is it we want more of? Or, and if you want to put this negatively, what is it that we individually or nationally try to avoid or don't want to happen, or we consider demonic or depraved, or what is it that we fear most? I think, for example, let me just give one example just to kind of get this going a little bit. I think that we have a deep kind of fear of cancer. Okay? I mean, these things can be good things, they can be bad things. I'm not trying at this moment necessarily to put a whole bunch of value judgments on them. That is, because why do we fear cancer so much? Because it seems to be mindless, right? I mean, it seems to strike at random, a child, an adult, a man, a woman, at any age. You can be, my best friend of several years ago fell into a ditch. Thought he had broken his leg when he fell in the ditch. It turned out that he had a tumor right here that had eaten away his leg, and it was because his leg broke that he fell in the ditch rather than the other way around. I mean, it's like it sort of sneaks up on you, you know, and you can have it and you don't know it and all that kind of stuff. So that's one thing. Okay, what is it that functions in this kind of way? I hope this isn't too vague. Let's see if we can get some things on this board here, individually and nationally, as God.
Well, as a nation, I guess as people, we don't want any privation. For instance, as long as we have more or all we want, we are willing to give to others. Mm-hmm. But if it's going to cost us something in higher taxes or lower standard of living, we draw the line there.
Okay.
Consequently, the national debt goes up and up because everybody's afraid to vote for taxes or whatever it takes to reduce the debt, because nobody in America wants to, the word suffer, nobody's going to suffer, I guess, be deprived of anything.
Okay, no privation or deprivation, well, something like that. I'm trying to get it down to short. I think you're right.
Defense is an obsession.
Defense? Defense is an obsession. A national obsession. Yeah, you bet.
We want the power to control.
Freedom?
Yeah, that's an ongoing issue for me. Like early in this week, I kind of had to come into the sessions clear that I had enough content to talk for an hour, even though I was told not to talk for an hour. And that's an anxiety power kind of thing, or control kind of thing. And I'm late enough in the week now that I can relax and say at the beginning of the session, well, what do you think about it, you know? And then I will go to power, control. I think that's an issue for a lot of us individually as well as nationally.
I was going to say, it could be individual,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I
agree.
Well, maybe I'll just draw, put it over here. Actually, these... whether they're individually or nationally.
Well, I mean deprivation for a national and individual because, you know,
okay.
I don't know anybody, well, I guess I know some, but most people will not deprive themselves of anything to provide a home for the homeless or feed the poor in this nation or across the seas if they're going to have to give and have less for themselves, sacrifice for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too.
It's just
and actually, most cultural things or national things are inside of us, yeah, as well as out there in the culture. Sometimes when I want to do cultural analysis, I mean, I hate this. It's just awful. Sometimes when I want to do cultural analysis, I look at inside myself. And it's kind of appalling because then when I get done, all I see is a kind of cultural clone. You know, I'm just another one of those things that the culture stamped out along the way somewhere. And I don't like that. You know, I like to think of myself as something more than just another cookie in American culture. What else?
Security.
Security, both nationally and individually.
Personal right.
And of course, in terms of the Harvest of Peace resolution that I've been emphasizing for the letter writing table, that's a lot of what it's about. We have defined security in terms of defense. rather than in terms of food, clothing, shelter, education, health care, things like that. We have let the word security mean, I mean, when you say, when do you feel secure? Most of us are going to say food, clothing, stuff like that. But we've let the word kind of be co-opted by the military. Anyhow, I shouldn't start commenting. Other...
This is really part of that no privation. I think we ought to have to put it on as an individual. Things.
Things. Okay.
Material
okay. Things.
Yeah, I should have put this the other way.
I was thinking more individually, but I suppose it can be both.
Okay. Well, okay. Well, we'll just leave it like this unless we run out of space, just to save a few seconds. I get used to creature, see a column right there. Anything else strikes you?
Entertainment.
I think that's a very big one. It's the individual.
And
see, I'm a pre-baby boomer, okay? I just discovered that Ralph Huguet and I went to seminary together, for goodness sakes. Haven't seen each other since 1962. Anyhow, I have trouble getting in touch with this let's go to the movies thing that happens even at Bread for the World. They'll go to the cheap movies, they'll leave work half an hour early, and they'll go at 4:30 so they can get in for a dollar, dollar and a half, something like that, because they really can't afford to go to movies on a regular fare paying basis. But two movies a week, three movies a week, something? It's amazing. I mean, it's just not a real part of my consciousness. It's a generation thing. Another way of asking this question is, what are we willing to spend big dollars for? And clearly, entertainment. One tour of a rock group can net, gross, millions, $8 million for a tour of a really good, the Rolling Stones.
Well, look at athletics, that's entertainment.
Athletics?
TV, millions of dollars in broadcasting.
Okay.
Football and so on.
Athletics and movies and
music, yeah.
VCRs.
Rock stars, VCRs. You're playing right into something I want to do later. It's wonderful. Thank you. Appreciate that a lot. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, as much as we hate to admit it, I think we're as individualistically concerned about defense as quote, everybody else is too, because the home security systems, the guns,
very good point.
The guns, locking your car,
very good
point. All that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We
very
do as individuals.
I hope I don't skew things too much by having this up here. Maybe you haven't looked at it yet. But this one day in the life of American children, I don't even know if you can read it from there.
Not from here.
But it's from the Children's Defense Fund. And this to me is one of the most appalling figures in all of this. 135,000 children bring a gun to school every single day. One American children. Now, this is not worldwide. 135,000 American children carry a gun to school.
What is that, 15 and under? What age do you take that to be?
I mean 18 down.
18 down.
And where is it? 10 kids die every day from guns.
Oh, I believe that.
Now, Bread for the World doesn't work on, gun issues specifically. We're focused on poverty and hunger. But I think that's such a startling figure. Mm-hmm. The things I do here aren't only Bread for the World. In fact, a lot of it's my own opinion and stuff. But I think that's, and I do think we're afraid. I moved into a new neighborhood. I didn't know the neighborhood. I knew that there were apartments over there. I knew there was drug dealing over in those apartments. First couple of nights I slept in that house, I was like spooked. The floorboard would, a new house, you're not used to just the sounds of a floorboard cooling or warming or something like that, And you're half awake all the time. And then I moved in on October 10th, and just before Christmas, somebody tried to kick in my back door, and I got further nervous, and now I sleep fine and put in a new door that's a little more substantial, and everything's fine. But I think we're very nervous about that. I know people in South Texas who you know, women in particular, who if they're out driving at night, they have a gun in the car, you betcha. You bet they do.
It was one of the first things when I walked in here, went to our dorm. What, I can't lock the door?
Yeah, it's been lovely, hasn't it? I'm really enjoying this,
Because you just don't think where you are.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I leave my wallet in the room and go off, and then I need a dollar, you know? I need to buy a stamp, but I don't have my wallet.
Can't spend it if you don't have it.
That's right. Yeah, you were.
Well, it's so ironic, because looking at that side of the room, what I was going to say was health and fitness, what we spend on how
exactly,
we value.
Exactly.
Idolize health. And I suppose you can put beauty in there, too, the whole cosmetic industry.
Yeah.
But then on the other side is where it isn't.
Now, health and fitness may not be so bad as beauty.
Oh, I don't know.
Well, we want a healthy nation.
How many for health? How many for... I just put it up there because there was space up there, and I know it's a little higher on the board, you can see it. Uh-huh. And Jane, you wanted to say something a while ago, did you get in?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, more for me, it's something like experiencing everything. It's a sort of individualism, you know, saying that I deserve to experience, whether it's, you know, rafting on somewhere or traveling to any part of the world I want to, sort of, we think it's our right to experience everything.
The whole travel business, for instance, and cruises,
all the bus tours.
The tours.
Yeah,
the free
to
go around once in
a while. Yes, let me get that
one. Holy go to around the world once. And travels. I think there must be another generational thing floats around in there. My mother, for example, who is, she'll be 80 in January. It must have been a thing in her generation to have been in all the states.
Really?
It's like a psychological thing. She doesn't care, really, if this is Ohio and she's in Pennsylvania and she goes like this. She was in Ohio and it counts. And it's like a number thing in her head, and you know, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's a regional thing. Maybe it's not a national thing. Curious. Anyhow, that's just in passing. Yeah.
Success.
Success. You betcha.
Collecting points.
I didn't hear what you
collecting
said.
Collecting points, like I heard the other night.
Points. Yep.
Well, I find lots of young kids eating out. I don't know where that would come.
Eating out.
We Americans spent, in the United States alone, not counting the international operations, $11.4 billion at McDonald's in 1988. Yeah. $11.4 billion at McDonald's in 1988. Okay. It helps put some of our food programs in perspective. We spent on food stamps. In 1989, we spent $12.9 billion. So we spent $1.5 billion more on food stamps for 18.8 million recipients who got a maximum benefit of 91 cents per meal, an average benefit of 58 cents per meal. We spent $1.5 billion more than we spent at McDonald's. That doesn't count Burger King, Wendy's, you know, whatever else. But we lose sight of it. You know, we don't see it in its cumulative. I wish I had with me, since you mentioned beauty, I've had the figures. I've got it. It's in that little thing I wrote on spending the peace dividend on shampoo and cosmetics. I mean, it's innocuous things. You know, it's the shampoo mm-hmm. I washed my hair with this morning. It's stuff like that. You know, it's a lot. You look it up. It's a lot of money. Dog food. Okay.
Well, you know, it seems like we're victims of advertising. We buy whatever they tell us to buy. You can't use the simple shampoos we were raised with. I don't go out and buy the salon product.
I'm going to share a little bit of this writing stuff with you. And that's the, if I had paid you, you couldn't have said a better thing right now at this particular moment in what we're doing here. How do you figure out what America values? Look at the ads in your newspapers. Look at the ads in your magazines. Look at the ads in People magazine. I think that, you know, those people, look, just think about the advertising industry for a minute. And the money they, of course, consume is an enormous amount. Your job is on the line if you're in the ad industry. Your mortgage, your kids' education, your pension. If you don't come up with something that is convincing to the American people, right? Now, let's say you're very bright, okay, and creative and motivated, but also behind you there's that thing that if you don't produce, you're out. And it's a very short timeline on that stuff. It's very quick. It happens very quickly. For that reason, I would hunch that advertisers know more about us probably than anybody else. Because it's their job to be able to reach into our insides and hook us. It's what they do. Their livelihood, their ambition, everything hangs on their ability to troll out that line and to pull us in. Either to convince us that we need something, or to hook what we already have going, and then, you know, and pull us into it. So one of the things I did a year or so ago was I looked at some of the ads in a couple of magazines. I looked at the New York Times, Sunday Magazine, and People Magazine, and I just thought, well, what can I learn about American culture by looking at these ads? And so I'm going to share a little bit of that with you. The New York Times Sunday Magazine, of course, pitches to a different audience than People Magazine, okay? Thus, in the New York Times, you are invited to have an imaginary drink of an Italian liqueur by the Trevoli Fountain in Rome, okay? I mean, they get you to think kind of big, you know? And probably a lot of people who get the New York Times have traveled and they've been to Rome and they can imagine that, you know, and all that kind of stuff. In People Magazine, you're sipping Seagram 7 and playing 8-ball. Okay, so it's a different, it's a more popular crowd. Or, I think this is great. This is my dedication to the Singles Week, although most of those folks are getting ready to leave right this minute. The Crown Royal. Crown Royal Scotch. Here was the rhyme that was in their ad. It's great. Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his Crown Royal, and now Jill is dating some guy from L.A. Is that great? Is that great? I mean, that's just great. I can't believe. It's funny, but what does it say to you? What does that say to you? It says if you don't have the right scotch, you're not going to be successful in your social life. So by golly, you know, you better get out there and get some of the Crown Royal.
Status
and some of this.
Should go up there, shouldn't it?
Yeah, status. Yeah, maybe that's close to success. I don't know.
These are sophisticated people this is aimed at, really. How can people...
Well, look what it's done. I copy it down. I bring it. I read it to you, and I've just done an advertisement for Crown Royal.
Right.
No. Does it work? It works. It works. The adjectives that jumped out of the New York Times ads. It was really quite amazing. It was close to Christmas. It's classic. It quote suits your style. It is, quote, impressive. Means if you want to, you have to read it back. If you want to impress people, you will buy this. An ad for furs said, more is more. You know, we're all trying to do more is less, you know. Or less is more. More is less is more. Anyhow, they don't care about that stuff. More is more. Say, more exclusive personal service, more professional and creative expertise, more selection of premier quality furs, more exquisite fashion. Elegant. In this particular New York Times Sunday magazine that I looked at, it says you can buy limited edition cashmere socks. Yeah. Now, what makes them a limited edition?
Not many people will buy them.
That's right. That's right. And why? Because they're expensive, right? So you get the feel better than the rest of those people. Now, cashmere is probably great to wear. Okay, I suspect it really is. But you get the feel better than all those other jerks out there. Why? Because you got more money to waste on your socks. Right? Quote. This is a quote from a fur ad. In his fur, his being the guy who, the name, I don't know, whoever uses these. In his furs, I feel luxurious, sensual, dramatic, and individually me. Individually me? Give me a break. You know, this stuff is mass produced. What makes it individually me is you're the only one on the block can afford this thing, okay? Our individuality as human beings purchased by the size of the price. We can afford the quote, somebody else can't. Who was it said, I've been rich and I've been poor and richer is better? It's probably true. In spite of all the good talk you hear other places, yeah.
A lot of these, too, as far as what the God is, has to do with comfort, because...
Comfort?
I mean, I like these products.
Yeah.
There are wonderful products on the market, even like the shampoos you were talking about. There's a big difference from using one to the other. It feels great to use the better one.
Sure.
You know, and even, like, my circle of friends, maybe we're trying to be more socially aware. We buy the best sweats that they make. We'll pay $50 for a sweatshirt just because it's such good quality, and we convince ourselves that we deserve to feel that good or something. There's something about we've lost the sacredness of being God created good. We want to be spectacular or best.
Okay.
So I think that comfort is somewhere in there.
Yeah. Okay, I think it is too.
It is. But isn't there a recycling of money this way that might not otherwise get recycled?
Well, I'm not saying these things are all entirely bad, okay? I mean, after all, I said $11.4 billion at McDonald's. A lot of kids got their, you know, I mean, and a lot of people worked. That didn't all just go for meat, say. It went for jobs. It went for, you know, maybe healthcare benefits. And so, money gets recycled this way. And a lot of this, even though I'm sort of making fun of some of it right now, in fact, to be more honest about it.
Well, think of when we cut down the military force, how many unemployed military people would be thrown into the workforce.
Right. One of the interesting things about that is, however, that $1 million spent on human needs as opposed to the military would create every $1 million spent on human needs, I think this is the correct figure, I have it written down here somewhere, would create 6,000 more jobs than it creates in the military.
Oh, sure.
That is to say that money spent on human needs is more job efficient than money spent on the military. This particular issue, the New York Times had an article about the pleasures. They had a major article about the pleasures of Christmas giving. Well, the reason they have this kind of article is because they're hustling ads, you know, for this particular issue. So the article tells you about all this stuff, and then you look at the ads. Purses averaged around $400, shoes about the same, a clutch bag was $1,050, a robe was $1,600. Bear in mind that $400 is 1.5 times the annual per capita income of millions of people on the earth. That is what one person pays for a clutch bag is another person's entire year's income.
Well, why the Christmas advertising brings out the worst, you know, it's just greed. I don't like the Christmas ads at all.
Yeah. I don't either. It's part, you hook into it. I do. I mean, I try to avoid it, and I find myself buying into it. I even use their metaphor, buying into, right? So, what are the myths, rites, and symbols of American culture? Myths, rites, and symbols. What is a myth? A myth is a story that we tell over and over that confirms our identity. Many of the stories in the Bible are myths. That doesn't mean they're untrue. They're identity stories. They are stories told over and over to say, who are we? A lot of church history has that kind of mythological character. They may be factually correct, they may be factually incorrect, but that's not really nearly so important as the fact that we believe them. That is to say that we say, yeah, that's who I am. Rites are the rituals we go through, the actions we repeat over and over again. I think one of the great, and symbols, of course, are things like the flag, you know, with which we attach great emotional meaning. You know, you all remember during the Vietnam War, on the one hand, you had families who may have lost a son, more likely a son than a daughter, but may have lost a son in World War II, for whom the flag meant something very profound. They had given a child to this flag. Not the flag literally, the flag was just a piece of cloth, but for what that flag stood for. And other people, you know, were burning flags. So because they felt they were focused on what's happening to Vietnamese children. So I'm not at this moment saying a right or wrong here. I felt real kind of torn, and I felt a sympathy for kind of both sides of that one. I was just old enough to remember World War II as a little kid, and so it wasn't so easy for me as it seemed to be for some people that I was around. But in either case, it served as a symbol, that is, a something with deep kind of evocative meaning around which people rallied. The cross as a symbol. Although the cross has rather largely lost its symbolic function, I think. Yeah. Oh, I think so, yeah. It's jewelry. It's worn all the time. It has very little meaning. You want to see a cross that has some meaning, you look at a cross in a Hispanic Catholic setting, and you will see a bleeding Christ on the cross. It's not just a high stylized pieces of wood or art object. I think that, you know, the cross has to do with suffering and blood and gore and death. It's a rather strange symbol to hang in front of. Really, perhaps, should have had a symbol of resurrection as Christian people. It's kind of a strange symbol. It's a death symbol. The cross is a symbol of death. But in our churches, we don't want it to look like death, so we make it look pretty. But we're stuck with the symbol, so we try to pretty it up. But in Hispanic culture, where a lot of people are very poor and where they suffer, they want a God who they can identify, who is like them. A God who suffers. And so they have the bleeding Christ, they really do.
But it's not resurrected either.
No, that one's no more resurrected than the other. No, right, that's right.
Protestants take the figure off the cross. They have the empty.
Yeah, empty cross, yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's a good
let's
point.
Let's devise a different symbol.
That's a good, yeah, let's do that this morning, and we'll announce it at lunch. And
the house of flame.
we'll just get on with it, yeah, right. I think one of the great myths in American culture is the Horatio Alger myth. I even went back, and whenever I can find one, I buy one of those books. They're all pretty much out of print, but occasionally you can find them. Horatio Alger was a Unitarian clergyman who wrote these wonderful little stories. If you actually read some, you've heard the name. You know, this is, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and all that kind of stuff. Luck and Pluck. What is it? Dick and something. Luck and Pluck. But they're about this young boy. All these stories, he got so good at it, and he wrote so many of these books, he kind of retired from being a clergyman and just wrote books, which does happen to people sometimes when they're successful, as defined by American culture. Sorry, I got distracted. I distracted myself by the humor in it.
A little boy.
Yeah, Luck and Pluck. Here's this little guy, and he's on a young guy, you know, and he's got this widowed mother, and she's renting the land, or he's got a lease, and his father has died, you know, and she's trying hard to pay off the lease, so he bravely leaves home, and he takes the train to the big bad New York City, and on the train, there is a woman whom he knows not, and some guy tries to steal the woman's bag, and he, you know, like any good young American, male or female, rushes over there and stops the thief. Turns out the woman is very wealthy. When he gets to New York City, she gives him a job. He works hard. He doesn't carouse. He doesn't hang out in pool halls and do all this bad stuff. Okay, this is late 1900s here that we're describing. And he makes a little more and he saves it. And this is kind of the paradigm, the American paradigm. Horatio Alger. In fact, in the stories, it's as much luck as it is work. Yeah. That's one of the curious things about those stories when you actually read them. It isn't just hard work. I mean, he happens to be on the train. Then what happens is he goes back and he brings back salvation to his mother just as this greedy landlord is about to kick her out. See, and then he's got this sweetheart, Becky is her name, in the particular one I'm remembering. And she's your, you know, freckle-faced American strawberry blonde or something like that, you know. And they're kind of sweet on each other in a sort of 19th century sense, you know. And he saves his mother, and it turns out that the landlord, this vicious landlord who is going to take away his house and kick his mother out, actually had been in a business deal with his father, and when his father died, there was not a written contract around. They didn't know it, and the landlord actually owed the family money, and he discovers all this, he saves his mother. Meanwhile, the landlord, who's rich, see, now this is the poor family, work their way up. Then the landlord, who's rich, the rich landlord, has a son who goes to the city too, and he carouses and wastes and drunkenness and all that kind of stuff, and he gradually just slides right down the old tube. Well, I think that's one of the paradigmatic American myths. That is, you can succeed if you try hard enough. And that's the success thing we're talking about here, you know? Passion for Excellence, I haven't read it. Lee Iacocca, Be Number One, all that kind of stuff. Whether it's hamburgers or number one in all different kinds of missiles, you know, you have to be number one in every category. Submarines, this kind of airplane, that kind of airplane, this kind of missile, that kind of missile, whatever it may be. Anti-tank weapons and so forth. For every number one, there's a number two, and for every number two, there's a number three, and so forth. You know, that myth is largely not true. It's largely not true. Or at least it's predicated on accident. There are, you know, anyone who succeeds has had more luck than goodwill. They had the luck to be born with a body that works. Okay? A lot of people are not born with a body that works. I had a classmate in graduate school. He's somewhere here in this area, and I need to track him down. They had a child who's probably, I guess she's in her late 20s now, mid to late 20s, who was developed physically but never developed mentally. And I ran into this guy sort of like running into you today. We were at a convention, and we had dinner together, and he said the daughter was 22 or 23, 24, something like that at the time, and she was still in a crib and still diapered and still being changed every day. Don't tell me she had an equal chance to be president of Chrysler Motor Company. I mean, I won't stand for that for a millisecond. We do not start out equal. We are not equal along the way. We do not have equal abilities of various kinds, nor are we socialized the same way. I mean, I don't even understand it exactly. I have four kids, you know, and I have one that's a sort of a marginal dropout, although is making it sort of today, and one who is upwardly mobile and pulling in money just as fast as he can pull it in. You know, buys a house, fixes it up, sells it, makes $40,000 on that one. I mean, he makes more in a year or two, you know, than I've managed to accumulate over my many years, you know. So why? I mean, they're two kids, the same family, you know. Just differences. A lot of differences play into it, most of which are just kind of accidents.
This attitude is demonstrated. Yeah. Went to Seattle last week and checked into a motel. And she's wearing this sales tax. And I said, oh, yeah, that's sales tax. And she says, saw that I was from Wisconsin. Do they have an income tax there? And I said, yeah, they do. She said, do you like it? And I said, yes, I think it's more equitable.
Uh-huh.
I said, the sales tax is, you know.
It's regressive. Yeah.
Really, yeah, it's hard on the poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the poor people, they can get jobs if they want them.
Uh-huh.
I said, what do you mean?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So we had a little discussion there.
Uh-huh.
But that's the prevalent attitude.
It is.
You still had your motel room, didn't you?
Therefore, no, I didn't.
Yeah.
The therefore, I think we've missed one. We escape a lot. You know,
when you don't make it, you
escape either through drink or drugs or taking medicines or aspirin or escaping from whatever is imperfect, you know.
Yep, for sure. We spend a lot of money doing that, a lot of money. One of the things I had down here was, and it's interesting then who become our cultural heroes. No matter what you say, Rocky, Indiana Jones, and Batman, people like that, they are our mythical winners, okay? And I grew up with these people too. I mean, I grew up with Superman. You know, I thought that that's probably why, that may be why I'm in social ethics, you know, because of Superman, you know. Yeah. You throw a little Superman in with the Christian gospel, and what do you got? Somebody who wants to save the world through the church. I mean, that's about what those two mix out to.
Rambo, unfortunately, is a hero.
Who?
Rambo.
Rambo is a hero. Oh, Rambo is a hero? I had a counter-hero. My counter-hero was Albert Schweitzer. Sure, I went on to read later that not all that stuff he did in Africa was so wonderful, and you know, and maybe he wasn't someone you'd wanted to be around all the time. But I don't know that there are so many counter heroes these days. Counter examples: Martin Luther King Jr. Where do you? I don't really know. I'm out of touch with this reality. Where is it that young people, Mother Teresa? Where is it that young people today get these counter images that give them alternative possible ways to think of themselves? And even Mother Teresa, from a public policy perspective, is regressive. She's a good symbol of concern. She's not a good symbol of solving problems, because it's again, the meliorist approach, kind of the help one person at a time rather than change the structures that create poverty and hunger and so forth.
You kind of need both.
Huh?
You kind of need both.
Yeah, you do need both. Ultimately, you need both. But you don't, you know, we don't have many symbols of the structural change. People, other than Martin Luther King Jr., clearly he was such a symbol.
Gandhi.
Who?
Gandhi.
I don't know. Do young people identify with Gandhi? Is he a strong figure?
I think in the 60s and early 70s, maybe. In the hippie movement, kids did.
It seems the young people I bump into, and I don't spend a lot of time around young people anymore, it's rock
young
culture.
People are very shallow right now.
Sports stars today.
Sports stars, yeah. We really do need some additional symbols. And yeah, I wouldn't give up Mother Teresa for anything. You know, I can affirm what her as symbol and reality, and at the same time point out that, like tax policy, it's also a little regressive. That is to say, it gets people to believe that that's the way to solve the world's problems, and it isn't. It is an important symbol of concern, commitment, compassion. Anyhow, one of the things I had down here was, would you believe, you only go around once. It's confirming to know that at least when I sit in my own little corner, some of these things seem to come out the same. Or get yours while you can, or put a little gusto into your life, or the bumper sticker, those who have the biggest toys win. I think, I don't care what we say about afterlife, I don't think most Americans at a practical level believe there is one. I really
agree with you.
But mentally, if you ask, do you believe in an afterlife, probably 98% of Americans would say yes, okay? First of all, they don't really believe in hell anymore. I mean, public opinion polls show that people basically don't believe in hell, okay? And second of all, there is no, if we really, 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 if I really, really, really believe that life is this sort of click that goes by that fast, and that all of eternity, everything would be perfect, then poverty isn't that important, nor is hunger, nor is justice, nor is war. In fact, the sooner you die, the better. Right? But Americans don't live that way. I'm sorry, what?
The lower you are, the better you'll have the next.
Yeah. But Americans don't live that way. I'm talking about the way we organize our lives at a practical level. We live as though we're going to get to a death point and it's over. And that's why we have to cram it all in now. We have to get all the entertainment, experience, travel, the I deserve to experience. I think that's a symptom of a non-belief at a gut level in an afterlife.
as I say again, I think that's a disparity between our kind of gut and our head. You ask us, we'll say we believe in it. If you say, how do we live our lives? We live as though we don't believe in it. Yeah.
But a strong belief in that isn't much, doesn't play out much differently. Because the, I don't know, the church groups that I know that have that real strong emphasis, like you were talking about, that this life is just a
that's interesting.
Snap of the finger.
That's
the way
point.
That plays out. They don't care about the arms race. They don't care about poverty because it's all just very temporary.
That's a good point, and I need to think about that. That's a, I appreciate that as a...
I think what the belief we need is that the kingdom of God is present here now. That's a Christian doctrine that we make a difference for us.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too, yeah.
Well, I think to a certain extent, the fact that people don't believe in a hell is good. Because having lived my life as a gay person, I know what living in fear does.
Uh-huh.
And operating on a fear basis is not the way to live your life.
Right.
You can't live your life
I'm not
in
advocating
fear of what's
hell.
Going to be beyond this
right.
life.
Right.
But you're saying we need to have, there's a, needs to be a balance there.
Well, I'm not really claiming we need. I'm not claiming we need a hell or anything. I don't know whether I am or not. You're ahead of me. I'm not thinking as fast as you are here at this point. I'm not advocating that we believe in hell or heaven. I'm just trying to point out that it's sort of disappeared for most people. It's a descriptive statement. I'm not trying to say what we ought to believe in here in heaven, hell, whatever. Just, I think that, I don't think most people function. Most of the people I know don't think hell is a possibility for them, at least.
And they don't think much about sin.
Or sin,
but
yeah.
But how do you account for the great resurgence of the fundamentalists, then? Those are the churches that are growing.
That's the other side of the coin.
And they preach sin and hell.
Yeah, I don't know.
They also preach the American dream, though.
Yeah,
that's
right.
That you can ignore all what we're talking
that's
about.
Right.
A lot of I went to with a someone I was I knew went to a church or a church. It was a religious meeting in a hotel because they didn't have enough money together yet to buy a. It's one of these independent churches.
Right.
And what their message was God loves you and
you will succeed.
You will succeed.
And if you don't succeed...
And I thought that was sort of just things critics said. And I mean, I was actually there in the worship, and that was the message. And they'd stand up and say, you know, they'd do individual testimony.
Oh,
say,
right. Oh, yeah.
You know, God loves me, and I got this, you know, I wanted this Mercedes or whatever. I'm not picking anything. You know, I wanted this whatever. And God made opened this door for me. And so, I mean, I don't understand that talk at all. That talk is utter nonsense to me.
Terrible.
Utter nonsense. That means God gave you a Mercedes and killed this little kid over here. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah.
When you talk that way. 27 children die from poverty in the United States every year, 10,000 a year. 1,295 teenagers give birth every day. 6 teens commit suicide every day. 7,742 teens become sexually active every day. 211 children are arrested for drug abuse every day in our country. There are 1,849 children abused or neglected every day. 3,288 run away from home, and so forth and so forth. Every 30 minutes, a child is arrested for drunken driving. And you start saying God does this and God does that. You got to look at the negative stuff and say, well, are you willing to say God did that too? I don't think so. I think we want to have it one way and not the other. I don't know what, we're now beginning to run short on time, and I wanted to do two things. I wanted to finish this little thing I've got here, which I'm not going to do. I'm going to do the other thing because it's more fun. I think our central rights are going to the mall, families at holidays. I mean, these aren't all bad things, you know. I mean, going out, movies, restaurants, sports, football, baseball, which is real clear, the good and the bad, you know, and so forth. I think that in terms of symbols, the business of America is business. Used to be that the high place on the hill was the church, at least in America. If you go to some of the older towns in New England, it's usually a church that's on the hill. I mean, sometimes it's in the valley because it's on a hill in the valley because that's
And more likely these days, it's a bank or a business. What's the tallest building in town? Not the church anymore, unless you live in a very small town. Who owns the top of the hill? I was in Bend and stayed a lovely home with some members, Bread for the World. And I said, who owns the house at the top of the hill? And I don't remember. It was, and I, again, I don't want to pick on any particular occupation. That's not my point. I don't know if it was real estate or bank or something like that. But the business of America is business. I think Leon Iacocca said that, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. Whoever
he
said that.
And he's right. He's absolutely right. And that is a lot of this stuff here. The other thing I wanted to share with you, because
could
I think
just
it's
ask,
more fun.
Are you saying that American values are that much different from the rest of the world's values?
Well, I don't know. I don't. I really am kind of Americologist or something. I've focused more on American culture than I have on other cultures. Know more about it just because I'm here. We are exporting it. When I had the good luck to be in Indonesia, because someone else was paying for it, I see these big signs, big billboards on top of buildings, and they said, you know, something like, I've forgotten the exact wording. I took a picture. I have a slide of this. Like, do it the modern way. And it's a Marlboro man smoking a cigarette.
That's the American way.
Yeah, do it the American way. Do it the modern way. I think we're exporting it, certainly. I don't know how different it is. You know, I think it's shared with a lot of other cultures, probably. I wanted to tell you about was this. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I heard on the public radio station the other day, they were down on America because of the drug situation, and we're pointing our finger at Colombia and everything, and they're saying, and yet, on the other hand, we want to export cigarettes to Korea, which kills 10 times more people per year, you know, than the drugs do.
Part of the ag bill that's up for renewal in Congress this year is what happens to tobacco. Some of your food aid is tobacco. Not all food aid is good. Some food aid is terrific, saves lives. Jane was saying that she had seen some very good uses of food aid. But on the other hand, there was a time after the Surgeon General's report came out, and there was a dip in tobacco sales for a while. Since tobacco leaf is kind of quote vegetable, if you will, I mean it's not a bicycle.
Who's sending cigarettes for aid?
We're sending tobacco leaf. Some tobacco leaf was sent under food aid. They don't do that anymore. But we are encouraging. We do subsidize sales of tobacco leaf to other countries. I don't know if it's in leaf or processed form, actually. So some of your tax dollars are well spent. Some of them are awfully spent. And that's why you need to monitor this. That's why you need to keep it. We have Bread for the World. Now I'm Bread for the World. All the rest of this is just sort of my own view of things. If you can make this separation, I'm going to do this real fast. We have 6 minutes. Maybe I should save this and do it tomorrow night. Maybe I should.
Now we have our sheets.
Yeah, I already handed it out. Have a musical called Lazarus, which is being performed at churches and youth groups and so forth. And it starts out, and it's a lot of fun, and it's got a good message. Lazarus starts out with this table, and it's just set up wherever in the church or the Sunday school room or whatever. And it's got a tablecloth on. It's very simply staged. And these people come on. We've got Dives, the rich man, and his family, brothers, wives, and so forth. That's the way it's described in the text. I didn't make up brothers and wives. That's what the text says. They come on and they're carrying platters of food and candelabra and they're singing, we're having a party, we're having a ball, and they're real up and kind of carrying on, you know, like that. And then so they sing their song, and then over here's a trash can. And in one of the performances I saw, the person at the trash can was black. And he sings, somewhat improbably, but musicals are always improbable, okay? He sings the Hunger and Poverty Blues. Fox has got holes, and little birdie's got nests. But I got no place to put my shoes. I got no pillows for to lay down my head. I've got the hunger and poverty blues. And if you have a trombone, wah wah. Okay, then you switch back to the rich family, and they're now going to say their table grace. We thank thee, God, that thou hast blessed us with that which we so richly deserve. We thank thee for the meats, the sweets, and all the eats, the house, the car, the VCR. We thank thee that we are not like those bums on the street, always looking for a handout to eat, and so forth. And then you switch back, and this time by the trash can is a child, a white child, in one of the performances I saw. Lazarus is many kinds of people. Lazarus is black, Lazarus is white, Lazarus is male, Asian, African, Latin American, female. In the performance I saw, they had people in wheelchairs, not as some kind of hokey kind of thing, but people whose lifestyle is to be in a wheelchair as part of the chorus. It was really very nice. Anyhow, a child sings this, Mama, I'm hungry. I'm not on pitch for these things. I'm not hitting these intervals right. When will we have bread? My tummy is rumbling like a bear. And then she goes on, and her mother is sort of holding her, and she sings a lullaby. Hush now, my baby, there's nothing to eat. And it goes on. Well, the story goes on. And in the course of things, of course, the rich man and Lazarus both die, as in the parable. It follows the parable quite well, up to a point. At the point of their death, massive poetic license occurs, okay? You have the confrontation with, quote, Father Abraham, as in the parable, but instead of being dead, see, the parable is very stark. I mean, I get mystified by a lot of what I hear in sermons and church and stuff like that. In the parable, what happens? Lazarus goes off to Abraham's bosom. The rich man goes off to eternal, to Hades, okay? Sort of eternal flames and punishment and hell. And I can't understand how people can sit in our churches every Sunday and hear this. I mean, we soften it. We make it seem like the parable doesn't mean it. But the parable's written for poor people. I mean, it's not, you know, primary. And it's written for rich people. It says, poor people, you're going to be okay, and rich people, you're going to get yours. But in any case, in our Lazarus, we make it a Scrooge. That is to say, he gets to wake up. So the rich man wakes up. He's had his confrontation in which all these Lazarus people have come to him and said, I'm your brother, I'm your sister, I'm your child. And he realizes that he has gone wrong and that he should have shared the crumbs from his table with these people. He should have shared with them. So he wakes up. And he gets to come alive, join Bread for the World, work for justice. And at that point, he calls together all these Lazarus people, the children and the adults, and he introduces them to his family and says, look, I have more family. I have a bigger family. It includes all these people. And at that point, they sing this song, which I'm going to sing the first verse, and if you want to try and join in, fine. And by the third verse, we'll skip the second and fourth. We'll sing first, third, and fifth. It's, I saw the people gathered. At this point, they sing. I saw the people gathered round Jesus on the hill with only five loaves and a couple of fish. 5,000 ate their fill, and all of them ate and were satisfied. All of them ate and were satisfied. When they shared what they had, it was multiplied, and all of them ate and were satisfied. How about joining me on the third verse? I saw the people gathered to share the heavenly feast. There were sisters and brothers, black and white, from the north, south, west, and east, and all of them ate